Welcome to Coffee and Literature with Eli and Todd, a high school class that is really a conversation.
About literature, not coffee. Ah, it's hot.
So today is episode 2 of our podcast. This week, Todd and I read As I Lay Dying. Todd and I found As I Lay Dying on the list of the top 100 books you have to read before you die. Why was it on there? I have absolutely no clue. Reading this book is like watching William Faulkner go insane at your expense. It's like he knows how much confusion the reader is going to go through reading the book, and he's laughing at you into a pillow the whole time. Normally, Todd and I keep a reading log of books that we've read, but I was just too confused to do so the whole time. The story is about a family of sharecroppers whose mother dies with a wish of being buried very far away in a town where her relatives are buried. Most everything that can go wrong does. Someone loses a leg, 2 mules die, someone loses a horse, and in the end they forget their shovels. All that isn't what's frustrating to read. What's frustrating is the narrative style that Faulkner chooses in this book. The writing is beautiful and the plot is relatively simple, but why would Faulkner let you enjoy that? The way he writes the story, it's like you're inside the mind of a 3-year-old narrator that was just fed methamphetamines. There are massive holes in the plot, and by that I mean Faulkner simply leaves out massive parts of the story and later refers to them as if they had been a detailed passage. Sometimes something will happen and you won't even realize till 2 pages later, at which point you say, oh wait, did something happen to his leg? You go back and read it, realize that there is nothing at all that reveals that something happened to his leg, and continue to read. Meanwhile, Faulkner will just continue writing about the broken leg, laughing at you as you wonder what in the hell could he be talking about. This book evoked a lot of emotions for me, 3 to be exact, but in large quantity. Confusion, frustration, and hate. It is so hard to know what is going on, and for me, for about a third of the book, it was so confusing it felt as if I was just listing off words on a page in no particular order. And I guess maybe there's a purpose to this. The book, in my opinion, is primarily defined by the word bleak. Everything is bleak, and there's not time in the book where you feel like, oh, things might be getting better. And the confusing and frustrating narrative style is likely used to make the reader feel just as bleak. There is no hope. No hope to understand what the hell is going on. Pure chaos. That's what this novel is. Chaos. The most chaotic part of the book, in my opinion, and coincidentally the only part that Faulkner had the heart to explain to the point of basic comprehension, is the barn scene. The Bundren family has been staying with a man named Armstead for one night and stored everything in the barn. That included, mind you, the stinky, rancid, ugly corpse of Addie Bundren, their dead mother. Buzzards circle the barn, and everyone stops to remark at the smell of death. The smell of rotting human flesh, left above the ground for over a week, with Anne's Bundren to blame, of course. Cash's leg is broken, they lost a horse and a team of mules. The carriage is on the verge of falling to dust, and everyone, I mean everyone, is sick of this stupid voyage on which they have sacrificed all but their lives. They've lost their dignity, their money, their things, their reputation. So Darl decides to take one for the team. During the night, he sneaks out, being caught by both Vardaman and Jewel, and lights Mr. Armstead's barn on fire, mother inside, in one final desperate attempt to end this disastrous journey. Not so much to Darl's despair, but more to mine, everything escapes the fire except the barn itself. And Darl and Jewel, with burns everywhere. Nobody seemed too upset with the intent Darl had. Everyone was done going on this stupid journey to bury their dead mother, and done being looked at with more disgust than before. Not only being country people, but being country people who had a reeking body in their carriage. Darl is clearly not in the best mental state, and collapses next to the coffin and weeps after it is recovered, which is only observed by Vardaman, mentioned not once in Darl's own narration. However, Darl isn't stupid, and if not smart, is incredibly observant. He knows that burning the barn, burning his stinking dead mother, would be doing everyone a favor. He also didn't have much of a connection to his mother, which makes it easy for him. The same can't be said for Jewel, which is something I'd like to touch upon in our discussion. As far as lessons go, William Faulkner did a great job hiding this one. Looking back on the book, I cannot find anything. Not a single part of the story that seems like it taught a valuable lesson. One could be, don't do stupid things like cross raging rivers on a rickety carriage when you can't swim, or don't burn people's barns down, or don't give Anne slack, he's still a lazy, underhanded, selfish prick. But none of those seem valuable enough to be the moral of a story, especially after the struggle of reading it page by painstaking page. And as I'm reading this, I'm realizing that there might be one great moral. This one great moral is the epitome of why edgy teenagers acting sophisticated love Faulkner. The moral that seems most likely to me is that sometimes, even after a massive struggle, after loss, after everything bad that can come your way does so, it just gets worse. On the very last page, Faulkner delivers one last blow. I think maybe the moral is that God owes you nothing. When everything's at its worst, God is fully within his rights to make things worse. And that's just how it goes. Nothing you can do about it.
The leap we made from The Little Prince to Faulkner's As I Lay Dying almost seems unfair to Eli. I could see him squirming a bit. I was reminded of how different it can be re-experiencing a shock with someone who is experiencing it for the first time, like watching a scary movie with my young daughter. Everything is heightened. I realize that my experience with challenging works of literature has come with years of acclimating to its frustrations, pretensions, and intellectual and emotional shocks. I am reminded that there is a darkness that literature can approach unlike any other art form. This is what Faulkner does. I would like to approach Faulkner from two viewpoints. The first is as if Faulkner had written or narrated the tale in a more conventional way, determining what lessons and morals we are to take from the Bundren family's hellish odyssey to bury their mother. The second viewpoint is more abstract. Namely what Faulkner does to the conventions of the narrator, which is really a kind of violence that illuminates his characters in an unconventional way. More than anything else in the story, I was struck by the deflation I felt at the end of the book. I feared a coming horror, but the futility, not the fear, was what seemed to pull the rug out from underneath me. There is no doubt that every character in this novel is fatally flawed. Perhaps this is most pronounced in Ants Bundren, the father, whose pride and sloth and selfishness are easily discerned and disdained throughout the story. Ants' character's defects reaches new depths in the final paragraphs of the book when he finally got them teeth and immediately finds a new woman after torturing his entire family in order to bury his dead wife. This futility hit me hard also when Darl, perhaps the most clear-eyed and indeed clairvoyant character, more on this later, descends into madness and is arrested. When Dewey Dell loses her abortion money to her father. When Addie admits from the grave her infidelity and disdain for her family. When Cash's cold, scientific, and simplistic worldview is only concerned with the tools that he may lose. When Vardaman can only understand death through the killing of a fish. And that Jewel still returns to this family after his father sells his beloved horse, perhaps the only vehicle for escape in the book. There's more. The lack of compassion an upright pharmacist has for Dewey Dell and her predicament. The outcome that Cora's solid faith in God doesn't help anyone else around her. And the fact that nobody thought to bring a shovel in order to bury their mother. So, in the end, Faulkner holds up places in the human psyche that are so flawed that we as readers are forced to acknowledge that there are journeys without growth and sins without redemption. At the end of As I Lay Dying, I find myself more deflated than horrified. Ance's purchase of the tea still hurts me. And oddly enough, I still find value in the lesson, even while some people shy away from the bleakness of the moral, because it is a cautionary tale that perhaps can only take place in the Deep South. Now to the other viewpoint in the book, which is Faulkner's treatment of the convention of narrator. Thoroughly modern, Faulkner does a violence to the storyteller, deconstructing classic narration by giving us a multitude of narrators, each perspective obscured and complicated by his or her flaws, desires, arrogance, and damage. Even when Faulkner resorts to first-person or third-person conventions, we as readers have very little to depend upon. At one point with Eli, I made the analogy between Faulkner's lack of narrative consistency to Picasso's cubist portraits. Both artists have mastered their conventions, but deconstruct and shuffle them to create a perspective that is both jarring and uncomfortable because it should be comprehensible, but instead feels foreign and exposed. This narrative cubism, for me, is best exemplified by the characters of Darl and Addie. Darl shows us Faulkner's experiment in that he embodies all the narrative conventions used in the book. His chapters utilize first person, third person, stream of consciousness, omniscience, and finally narrating about himself in the third person as he descends into a madness of affirmation. The way I see it, Darl is Faulkner himself, lost in the assumptions that narrators and storytellers take for granted. And then there's Addie, who only has one chapter, one voice, and one that is disembodied and comes from a corpse in a wooden box. She symbolizes not only the resentful and bleak underpinnings of the story, but also the deconstruction of language itself as a tool for narration. She is pointing an accusatory and decomposing finger at the way narrators use words. She says, quote, "That was when I learned that words are no good, that words don't ever fit even what they are trying to say at." And, quote, "We had to use one another by words like spiders dangling by their mouths from a beam, swinging and twisting and never touching." Unquote. Her point, and Faulkner's, is made even more starkly when Addie says, "He had a word too. Love, he called it. But I had been used to words for a long time. I knew that that word was like the others, just a shape to fill a lack." This is a pretty philosophical stance on the nature of language from a sharecropper's wife. So Eli asks, why? Why put the reader through these narrative hoops? Writing teachers are fond of advising their students to show and not tell. Faulkner, by systematically exposing and destroying and then recasting narrative, has found a way to show the dark inner psyches of flawed humans without resorting to merely telling us about it. The resulting experience is more stark, intuitive, provoking, and visceral, and does something to us that perhaps only literature can.
So, supposedly one of the top 100 works of literature that you should read. And
supposedly.
You don't agree?
No.
Why not?
I feel like reading this book was a detriment to my mind. And maybe if you want to read it right before you die, that's fine, because you won't be using your mind for very much longer.
It's a scathing criticism.
Good thing Faulkner's dead.
You know, sometimes when I think a teacher hears a student respond this way to a book, they might think, oh gosh, maybe I shouldn't have chosen this as content for you or whatever. But actually, I'm kind of not surprised by your reaction, and I still think it was a good choice.
No, I think it holds value, definitely.
What's its value?
I don't think the literature itself holds value to me personally, but I think I learned a lot from struggling through it. I didn't know that there was literature like that. I didn't know that there was things that could make you so angry just by reading. But now I know there is.
You've had a very emotional response. I mean, and I'm wondering if it's a new response for you, not just to reading a book, but maybe to kind of any, you know, artistic process.
Definitely, it's new for experiencing someone else's artistic process. I get mad a lot when I'm doing artistic things. I like to draw. I like doing ceramics and stuff like that, and especially ceramics. I'll be throwing on the wheel, and I'll just, like, throw it off a little bit, and I'll just freak out. And, I mean, it's the same type of anger. Like, what the hell, man? Like, and that was exactly the feeling I was feeling while reading this, was just this despair. Just why? What is going on?
I mean, he's no doubt, I mean, and I'm with you, he's intentionally challenging the reader.
Obviously, yeah.
And this is a modern thing. He's not challenging us by theme. He's not challenging us by character, protagonist, antagonist.
Yeah.
In fact, is there a protagonist in this story at all? I'm not sure.
No.
But he's challenging us by the way we tell stories.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said in my written response, he's breaking it down, busting it up, and it's uncomfortable because we're so used to stories being told a certain way, we didn't even realize we were being,
mm-hmm.
you know, told stories that way.
Yeah.
Have you ever had that reaction looking at a piece of art, like from Picasso or like Jackson Pollock? You know,
no.
You know who Jackson Pollock is?
Of course.
Yeah, okay. So you don't have the same reaction there?
No. Usually I look at, you know, visual things are very different because when you're reading something, you're putting together words to form an idea. And when you're looking at art, the baseline approach is to look at it and say, that looks cool. And with Jackson Pollock and with any impressionistic artist, you look at it, and if you don't understand it, at the very least, you can say, oh, that's cool. Because half of the intent of art, visual art, is to make something that looks good. Where when you're reading Faulkner, you're trying to gain a message from it. And when it feels like you're just listing words off of a page, it's really, really hard to find that message.
Hmm. I think some artists, and we can look deeper in this, but what I'm doing right now is I'm pulling up a work by Picasso called Guernica. And I don't think it's meant to be beautiful. And there's definitely a message to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that cubism. Also, I was telling you about.
Yeah.
And it's right here. Well, this is Guernica. In fact, gosh, it parallels, I think, really nicely with As I Lay Dying. It is, if I remember correctly, this is a portrayal of a bomb shelter during the Spanish Civil War.
Okay.
And you know, the people in here are screaming and in horror. There's a horse in there. There's definitely a message here.
Yeah.
I don't think it's meant to be beautiful. And it's definitely challenging the way we normally see a painting, a portrayal, even if it's something horrific, like people being bombed.
Yeah.
And it makes it, like I said, with Faulkner, I think this kind of deconstruction of what we're comfortable with
makes it more visceral.
Yeah.
And you definitely had a visceral reaction to this story.
Yeah.
Or at least the novel. That being said, let's transition to maybe something that stood out to you in the story and see if we can mine into that and why it might be relevant.
So what I said in my response was that I wanted to talk about everybody's reaction to Darryl burning the barn. And I said that most everyone was okay with it, but the one person who wasn't was Jewel. And I think at a very base level, that was because his mother treated him specially. She loved him, or at least acted like she loved him more than all the other children. And because of that, he had a special care for her. But I also think that there's something deeper there, and there's also something deeper with Darryl.
So let's take the barn literally. Jewel saves Addie from fire, or actually at least her body.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember if this is before or after Addie's disembodied narrative.
It's after.
Right, so it's really hard just to see her as a body still. I mean, she still feels like a character.
Yeah.
And Jewel is who also saves her from the flood.
Mm-hmm.
He saves her from the fire. Both are very powerful, almost, you know, biblical symbols. You know, the world is destroyed by flood. The world is destroyed in the apocalypse by fire. And here's Jewel kind of facing that.
Yeah.
And succeeding. I mean, maybe if there is a protagonist, maybe it's Jewel.
I think it's just a collection of people who sometimes do good things, sometimes do bad things, and then it's
not many good
all
things.
Of them antagonize and protagonize.
Maybe. But you know, the funny thing is
except for Anne's.
Yeah.
He just antagonizes the whole time.
He does.
Yeah. There's like one part in the book where I can remember being like, oh, he's not so bad.
Really?
Yeah, I was in like the first few chapters, he was like, he was sitting by Addie's bed, and I think it was Dewey Dell as she walked away, just like smoothed the sheets, and Anne's walks over and he like tries to smooth the sheets like she did, and he just messes everything up, and I thought it was kind of cute.
Oh, man.
But then he's just scum for the rest of the book.
Oh, Anne's frustrated me to no end. And like I said in my written response to that final paragraph where he gets the teeth.
Oh my God.
Just a punch in the gut. It's just so brutal.
I remember when you finished the book, we were sitting there in our little cubicle and you said, son of a bitch. Son of a bitch. Son of a bitch. Over and over again. And I was like, oh no, this is going to be bad.
It's funny because it's bad without being bad.
It really is. Yeah. Like what more could you expect from Anne's?
Right. I mean, I think it's worse carting around a rotting corpse.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's more horrific. But no, again, it's not horrific. It's that sense of futility, like, oh my God, it doesn't stop.
I think it's
stop.
The fact that he did that after he carted around a rotting corpse.
Yeah.
For 9 days.
Yeah. I don't know. These people are kind of numb to their world in a way, except for Darryl.
Except for Darryl.
And Darryl is a weird, interesting character.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I was trying to do in my reading log, instead of looking for quotes, which is normally what I do, is I tried to map out the narrative structure by just writing down whose voice we are hearing. That's not even an appropriate way to put it, because sometimes you'd have a narrator who is giving you someone else's voice. But
yeah.
But, you know, I mapped out, what did I say? And it was off 58 chapters. I guess there's actually 59. I missed one somewhere along the line. But Darryl, is as the narrator, pops up 19 times.
Yeah.
By way more than everyone else. And like I said in my response, I think Faulkner and Darryl are one. I think authors are weird that way. I'm going to
compared also to, I mean, you're a big fan of Vonnegut.
Yeah.
And there was always something you see in Vonnegut's Breakfast of Champions. I don't know if you read that one.
Yes, it's my favorite one. It was actually the first Vonnegut I read.
Nice. Well, in a similar way, Vonnegut enters his own story.
Yeah.
As the author, and he wears mirrored sunglasses because it's a, he says it's a terrible thing to look into the eyes of your creator.
Yeah.
And I see that also with Darl and Faulkner.
Definitely.
And here is Darl, who has all this omniscience, this clairvoyance, this almost weird access into other characters' heads, this knowing of what's going to happen.
Knowing what's going on, even when he's miles away.
Right. Much like a narrator does when he's telling the story.
Yeah.
And, of course, who is most punished at the end is Darl.
Yeah.
He becomes totally insane. He's locked up. His I mean, in fact, it blew me away that of all the characters to be kind of shunned by the family, it's Darl.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Dewey Dell attacks him.
Yeah.
What? No one attacks Anse.
That's what I was about to say. Nobody gives Anse shit.
Yeah.
I mean, they give him shit, but he sticks around. And that's better than Darl got.
But what a weird access into a character.
Absolutely.
And I don't think any author can do that without busting. It's maybe one of the problems with the conventional narrative structure is it's really hard to get into the deep into the mind of the character.
Yeah.
But by painting his picture this way, we can.
Yeah.
It's frustrating as hell. I get it. But that's the outcome.
Absolutely. No, there are advantages and disadvantages. Definitely. I just like to be negative.
No.
It's a more accessible emotion.
I think he is provoking you intentionally.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it's easier to write about that than to write about how great this book made me feel.
You made a comment in your written response about teenagers who like this because it makes them feel sophisticated. What did you mean by that?
All right, so while I was writing that, I had this picture in my head of, if you've seen South Park, there's the three goth kids.
Yeah.
And they're always walking down the hallway with their black trench coats, smoking cigarettes. They're like, we're sophisticated, we're above you. And that's just...
And that's who reads Faulkner.
And that's who reads Faulkner.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, it is hard. It is hard reading. And ideally a couple things I appreciated about doing this with you. First of all, you never gave up.
I came very close.
Well, I appreciate your effort and perseverance there. I mean, you pushed through something that was very difficult. And then also, you didn't pretend understanding where you had none. And maybe yeah. That's the pretension that you're talking about.
Absolutely.
You know, even the way we're talking about now, I mean, I'm speculating about Faulkner.
Yeah.
Trying to bust stuff up.
I am making a podcast about William Faulkner.
Yeah, well, you need some more eyeliner.
Oh, how the world goes around.
I started seeing the characters representing different things. Like, I love the, well, I don't want to say love, but I was struck by Cassius Saw throughout the whole death process for Addie. I mean, it was this constant grinding, this sawing, which is, if you think about it, a destruction, right?
Like you're
separating something that was whole.
Yeah, because Addie was holding the family together.
Maybe through her disdain.
Before she dies, everyone is fine, you know? They fight, they bicker, but that's like a normal family. But as soon as she's gone, everything falls apart.
Hmm. But that's intentional on her part.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is
absolutely.
She
And I think that might have been part of it. She was holding the family together so that when she died, everything would fall apart.
Yeah. I mean, she's a, I don't know, she's a dire character.
She really is.
I mean, you know, I'm getting back off Cash, but she doesn't like the family she comes from. It's like she's constantly trying just to find her alone time.
Yeah.
Right, which you can't even do in death.
Yeah.
Without Vardaman drilling a hole in her face. and then she has these... Well, and then she meets this man who's... Whatever love he might have is a violation in a way.
Yeah.
And then she has these children, which almost approaches love, but she can only love them in the sense that she wants them to feel her pain.
Yeah.
That's messed up.
Yeah. She's... not right in the head.
No.
Obviously.
None of them are.
No. Well, I think Darl, before he goes insane, is a pretty normal guy, aside from, you know, superhuman telepathy.
I'm with you, actually. I mean, of all the people, I thought Darl was...
He was the most reasonable, normal guy there was.
Right. And it was right and good of him to try to destroy that coffin.
Yeah.
Although it was at the expense of someone's barn.
Yeah. And I think we should go back to that. I think beside him, you know, destroying the barn and his mother just so that they could stop, which I was really rooting for him. I really wanted this to end. Probably more than he did. I think there's also something else there. I think Darl, before the barn, was the kind of guy that would have approached that with a grim, somber tone. You know, I'm burning down another man's barn with my mother inside of it. But he doesn't seem like that. And I think that's an indication of... I think his mental state starts to decline even before he burns down the barn. I mean, obviously everyone's mental state starts to decline before the barn, but I think for Darl, it's more catastrophic.
Hmm. We lose insight into his thinking.
We do.
By that point in the story. I mean, he's still a narrator, but we're not learning much about him.
No, we're not. I think there's a lot of, I don't know what the emotion is, but there's a lot of emotion going on in him, and I think he loses himself in that emotion. And I think that's most of the reason why he burns down the barn, because Darl is a pretty reasonable guy, and Darl, I think, in the first half of the book would recognize, I shouldn't burn down this guy's barn just because my mother is in it. You know, like, he could have dragged his mother outside and lit the coffin on fire. But I think he loses himself, that reasonable person. He loses the love he had. I felt that he did have a lot of care for his family, even though they were batshit crazy and stupid and I feel like ands is an adjective now.
I like that a lot.
But I think in the trauma of his mother dying and the trauma of the journey itself, he loses himself in the trauma. And I think when he starts laughing... I don't think that's new. I don't think that's his mind degrading even more. I think it's just him releasing everything that's been going on in his head for chapters.
In your written response, you said there was no moral to this, but you just kind of, I think, hit the nail on the head there with it's the trauma of the journey. And I think that's a big part of the human condition is if you're not careful, if you're journey becomes not derailed, but just goes off on this insane tangent, like this journey does, you know, you're screwed.
Yeah.
And how many people are on that journey?
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
And was there any here's a good question for this novel. Was there any way out for any of these characters?
Absolutely. A lot of them could have left if they wanted to badly enough. I think, well, so in the beginning, Jewel had the horse before Anne sold it. And Dewey Dell probably could have married that pharmacist on the spot.
Which one? The one that
raped
her?
Yeah.
God, but that's not an escape.
Well, I mean,
that's awful.
I mean, the situation is bad. Yes.
Yeah.
But considering the time period and the place that they were in, that was a relatively normal thing.
I don't want to. Yeah, that's hard for me. I don't want to normalize it. I also don't think that Dewey Dell had the kind of, I mean, from my perspective, none of them had an out.
Ever. Yeah, considering the people that they were.
Right. They were born into this.
This journey. They were born
into this journey. Yeah. And journey is almost too nice of a word. They were born into this trajectory.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's no way off. No. The.
Darl made it out.
This downward escalator they're on. Darl, you're right.
That might have been a double purpose, is if she burns, we all get to quit. If only the barn burns, I get to quit.
Interesting.
And he did. Yeah. He did get to quit.
God, and they all go right back to their, as soon as mom's in the ground. Maybe Anne's comes out a little bit ahead, but Cash, with his missing leg now, just is psyched about a record player. His tools. He's got his tools still. And Dewey Dell just is like, oh, well, she doesn't know what her next step is.
Yeah.
Vardaman's, they're just all sitting in the wagon. They're just on the same trajectory. It's not changing.
Yeah, except they have a lot less money, a lot less resources, and one less leg.
One less leg. Until
next time.
This is Coffee and Lit.
Elan Todd, out.
Out.